Sha'ul a break before we complete Shmuel Aleph. That'll wait until after Pesach. And this week, we're doing a Pesach Shir with two parts. The first part is still Tanakh. And I wanted to give a Tanakh Shir, and I thought I would speak about the Haftorah of the eighth day of Pesach. And my reason for that is twofold. Number one, because it's a great Haftorah, and it's called Od Hayom Benov. It is about the Assyrian invasion and Yeshaya's message to the Jews who are afraid of the Syrian invasion. And we'll talk about why this is being read on Pesach. And the other reason I want to give this shir, besides it being a great Haftorah, is because last Pesach I gave this shir on Yom Tov, and I couldn't therefore record it. And I wanted the opportunity because I really liked the idea. So I revisited it for this year, and I actually ended up switching stuff around, adding an idea, and it's almost unrecognizable from where it was. So the shir that I gave last Pesach will go unrecorded, but this is a better version. So that's what I want to do first. And so as you see on your source sheet, it's titled Spending Pesach in Nov. And then at the end, I want to spend a few minutes with a Dvar Torah on the Haggadah. Because I realized that in approaching Pesach, most people are really focused not so much on the Haftorah of day 8 as on the Seder they're going to be doing the first night. So we'll have something for your Seder as well. For those who want more for their Seder, I will note this coming Monday night is the second of two Haggadah nights from my Beit Midrash. It will be at Shari Shamayim. And 4 Divrei Torah. Starting at 8, you can be out by 8:45. 4 Divrei Torah, each one 10 minutes or less, given by members of my Beit Midrash. The speakers this Monday evening will be Rabbi Jared Enstandig, his wife Sarit Enstandig, Rabbi Stephen Gottlieb, and myself. And that Dvar Torah that I give there will not be the same as the Haggadah Dvar Torah that I give here. So you're very welcome to participate there and get more Seder Divrei Torah. But for now, we start out with spending Pesach in Nov. And you'll see why I say Nov very shortly. It is the same Nov as the one we learned about in Shmuel, but I wasn't thinking about that in terms of the Shir. So the text for this Haftorah starts in Yeshaya chapter 10 and runs all the way into Yeshaya chapter 12. So if you have a Tanakh, just open your Tanakh to Yeshaya, and that will serve. If you don't, I gave you a link on the source sheet for the Sfaria page with Hebrew and English. So you can look over there in order to follow along. But it doesn't start with sentence 28. The Haftorah starts with sentence 32. However, we are starting with sentence 28 for reasons that I'm now going to explain. The Haftorah begins in the middle of chapter 10. It's on your sheet. If you see source number 1, you see where it says Isaiah 10:28? So that's your starting point. So this Haftorah begins in the middle of a thought. Remember that Yeshaya is a prophet who serves, well, he serves for a very long time, actually, quite a few decades. But at this point, he is talking to King Ahaz. That's the target of his prophecy. And we'll talk more about the relationship between Yeshaya and Ahaz a little bit later. But this is a period when the Jews have already split into two kingdoms. You have the northern kingdom of Yisrael. You have the southern kingdom of Yehuda, or Judea. Yeshaya operates in the southern kingdom. He is a prophet in the city of Yerushalayim, the city of Jerusalem. His messages, as we're going to see, target, in particular, the aristocracy of Yehuda, of Judea. This is a time when the Assyrians, who are an empire off to the east, are planning an invasion. They control the entire region all the way up to Egypt, basically, at this point. And they invade the northern kingdom of Yisrael and exile the 10 northern tribes. And then ultimately they try to attack Jerusalem And miraculously they are defeated, and that's the story of Sancheirib in the time of King Chizkiyahu, which happens the first night of Pesach, right? That's one of the big events of the first night of Pesach. So are we oriented in terms of time and place? Is that clear? We need to know that, otherwise the whole story doesn't make any sense. So the vision of Yeshaya here is that Yeshaya is describing, apparently, an Assyrian invasion. So that early in chapter 10, he describes the Assyrians as being very arrogant. He says the Assyrians are going to be punished by God. The Jewish survivors of the Assyrian attack will be protected by God. But for now, Assyria is coming. The Assyrian invasion is arriving. And that's where we pick up. Chapter 10, sentence 28 in Yeshaya, where he describes the Assyrians in their army traveling from place to place to place in their attack. So in sentence 28 it says, they come to Ayat, they cross Migron, they leave their equipment in Michmas, I should say. We've seen Michmas actually in Shmuel. They cross some crossing. They stay in Geva. The Rama is trembling. Givat Shaul, another place from Shmuel. There's a lot of Shmuel here. Givat Shaul flees. Bat Galim cry out. Laish, you should listen. You might remember Laish from the end of Shoftim. Anasos, which is Yirmiyahu's hometown, is impoverished or is suffering. Madmena is made to go into exile. This is sentence 31. The dwellers of Gevim flee. And then you get Od Hayom Benov La'amod. Sentence 32. The day arrives in Nof to stand, and standing is the Assyrians who are standing. They, to wave their hands at the mountain of the daughter of Tzion, the hill of Yerushalayim. So the that's our beginning to this. Clear? It's the Assyrian invasion, and it's going to go on to describe how what will happen is not Assyrian conquest, but rather what is going to happen is a brand new messianic era. If you take a look at the end of chapter 10, the beginning of chapter 11, we are told that God is going to crush and bring down these arrogant Assyrians. And then we're told a sprout will come forth, or a shoot will come forth from the trunk of Yishai. A sprout will come forth from his roots. And he will have the spirit of Hashem, a spirit of wisdom and understanding, a spirit of counsel and might, a spirit of knowledge and awe of God. He will haricho, you may remember that, those who did Malachim with me last year, haricho b'yiras Hashem, he will have awe of God, and he will not judge by what he sees, he will not go based on what he hears. Everything will be based on justice. He will judge the cases of the indigent with justice, and he is going to rebuke those who are in need of rebuke, and he will, you can keep on reading, I'm just following along in the text loosely, he is a person of justice, he is a person of faithfulness, and the wolf will lie down with the lamb, and the leopard will sprawl with the kid, and the calf and the young lion the young ox will be together, and a small child will lead them, and the cow and the bear will graze, the lion will eat straw like cattle does. Very nice bucolic image of all the animals getting along and everybody getting along, and there's a lot of peace. No one is going to cause any harm on my holy mountain. The land will be filled with knowledge of God, like water covers the sea. I'm going to come back to that phrase. And on that day, the Shoresh Yishai, the root of Yishai, ancestor of the Davidic dynasty, all the nations are going to come to him, and his rest will be one of honor. At that point, all the Jews will be gathered back into the land of Israel, the Jews who have been exiled in all of their various lands, no longer will there be any hostility. And you can just read down the rest of chapter 11. It is a beautiful, beautiful image. God talks about making a path, channels for the Jews to cross through the rivers and the seas on their way back to Israel. And the Jews, in chapter 12, are going to say to God, wow, we are so grateful to you. We are so happy. You gave us comfort. We trust in you. Hine kel yeshuasi evtach v'lo evchad. I trust in you. I will not fear. God, you are my source of strength. You are my salvation, or you are a being of strength, and you were my salvation. And you will draw water with joy from the wellsprings of salvation. And you will say on that day, thank God, call out in his name, talk about what God has accomplished, what God has done, sing to God, he has done mighty things, this is known throughout the lands, you should sing, dweller of Zion, because the Holy One of Israel is great in your midst. And that's the end of the Haftorah. And so my question to you is, really nice Haftorah, really positive image, what does this have to do with Pesach? Why is this Haftorah for the last day of Pesach? Yes, Ricky.
Well, it's another saving of the Jews, like they were saved in from Egypt.
We've got lots of savings of the Jews in Tanakh. Thank God. We don't have a shortage. Why this one?
It's a return.
It's
a return to Israel. I mean, like the Jews left to return, well, they settled Israel in after Mitzrayim, and here we're returning to Israel from all over the place.
Good.
That's a connection.
Right. So I'm going to come back to that idea. Susan points out it is a story of Jews coming out of exile. I mean, it's addressed to Jews who are in the land, but it tells the story about Jews who have been exiled returning to Israel. Good. What else? Yeah, Hannah. Yeah, you're muted.
Something about the splitting of the whatever.
Right. So at the end of chapter 11, it talks about God making a path for us and drying up the waters of Egypt in order for us to return. So I think that's definitely there as a connection. I'm going to come back to that. These are good ideas. So let's talk about a few things here. First of all, I go back to something I said in the very beginning, which is that the Gemara thinks the reason why we read this on Pesach, is because it's a prediction of Sanherib's invasion, which is going to happen on Pesach. We generally assume that that invasion, which took place in the year 701 before the Common Era, according to historical records, which is recounted in Tanakh in a few different places. It's in Malachim Bet chapter 18, it's in Yeshaya chapters 36 to 38, it's in Divrei Hayamim in Chronicles 2 chapter 32. We assume that that's what's going on here. If you take a look on your sheet, source number 2, that's where the Talmud tells us that this is the Haftarah for day 8. It says, Yom Tov Ha'achron Shal Pesach, on the last day of Pesach, Korin Vayihi B'Shalach, we read B'Shalach, that's the story of crossing the sea, Umachtirin Vayidaber David, and the Haftarah is David's song, to echo the song of the Jews in the parsha, in the main reading, Ulamachar, and then the next day, Kol HaBachor, from Parshas Re'eh, Umachtirin Od HaYom, and the Haftarah is this section, Od HaYom B'Nov La'amod. Why? So Rashi, their comments, I brought it for you on the sheet, Odayom, Lefisha Mapalaso Shal Sancherev Baleo Pesachaya, because the fall of King Sancherev was the night of Pesach. This is the story of Sancherev's invasion. It happened, he collapsed on the night of Pesach, so therefore we read about this on the night of Pesach. Similarly, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which I brought you in source number 3, says that Sancheirev made 10 journeys on the day of his assault on Jerusalem, 10 being an image of something that is complete. And if you count up the places that he traveled, as listed in the beginning of our Haftarah, you get 10 places. So that is an explanation for why we would use this as the Haftorah. However, it's worth noting that, number one, we don't actually read the story. Right? The story of the invasion is found in Yeshaya. You could easily have read the story itself instead of reading this vision about the attack that's going to come eventually. So that's strange. That's number one. A second reason why this is difficult is pointed out by the writer Ruth Paz. I don't know if she is a professor or if she's just a writer. I looked around online and I could not find. There are a lot of people named Ruth Paz out there. It's apparently a very popular name. She wrote an article in the journal Megadim. And the article has the unwieldy title, which you see in source number 4. Hareka ha-histori l'masa ha-tzva'i ha-ashiri bi-Yehuda ha-mitoar bi-Yeshaya Yud. Which means, the historical background for the journey of the Assyrian military in Judea as described in Isaiah chapter 10. That actually was a better sounding thing in Hebrew. In any case, she argues that the text the text when we actually see Sanherib invade in Yeshaya chapter 36 and in Malachim, as well as the text found in the Assyrian record, indicate that Sanherib attacked Jerusalem from the southwest. He first destroyed the fortress at Lachish, and then he attacked Jerusalem. He's going up northeast in order to reach Jerusalem. Whereas if you were to map out the places that are listed here in chapter 10 of Yeshaya, of Isaiah, they describe a journey that's going from the northeast down. So he's coming from the wrong direction, if that's what it's describing. So Ruth Paz believes that that's not what was going on. She believes this was a later invasion by a man named Tiglath-Pileser, also Assyrian, obviously. But the story was, and I brought it for you in source number 4, but I think I might say it outside of the text, is that Tiglath-Pileser first attacks the city of Ashkelon in the days of King Ahaz. And he goes through Judea just in order to get there. And the story is told in Divrei Hayamim Bet, Chronicles 2, chapter 28, sentences 20 and 21. Tiglath-Pileser was called in to help Ahaz, king of Judea, but he didn't help. Instead, he attacked. And as the overlord, he didn't tell Ahaz what he was doing or ask for permission. And therefore, Ahaz was afraid that Tiglath-Pileser was going to attack Jerusalem. So this invasion, according to her, is not actually the invasion of Sanherib. It's a different invasion, which weakens the argument for reading it on Pesach. So one reason to read this may be, it looks like it's describing an Assyrian invasion that happened on Pesach, but there are problems with that. First of all, then you should have read about the story of the Assyrian invasion, not the prediction. And number two, this may not even be describing that invasion. So I'm going to offer two other answers. Are we clear? Understood? So the second answer I'll offer is that what we're seeing here is a message of change and growth, appropriate for the former slaves as their captors are vanquished and they move towards receiving the Torah. You have to go back to what I said in the beginning about Yeshaya himself. Yeshaya's goal here is to inspire a King Ahaz to change. Yeshaya is a prophet to kings. Those of you who were there when we learned Yeshaya on Tuesdays a few years ago will remember this. Yeshaya is very comfortable dealing with kings. Some argue that this demonstrates an aristocratic background, that he was actually born into aristocracy. The Gemara in Megillah says that his father Amos is the brother of Amatzia, who is the king of Judea, which means that the kings Yeshaya is rebuking are also his cousins, their family, which sometimes that works for you, sometimes that works against you. But that's the idea. Ibn Ezra makes this point. If you take a look at source number 5, I'm going to read out my English translation, but you see Ibn Ezra commenting on the opening of Yeshaya. He says, a loan view says that when a prophet's father is named, he was also a prophet. This loan view is a line in the Gemara. Ibn Ezra says, yeah, that's a view. There is a view that says that. If you see a prophet named and you name the prophet's father, that means the prophet's father was also a prophet. And one view says he was of royal descent. This is the Gemara I just mentioned. For Amots and Amatsia were brothers. And so the wicked of Israel could not harm him as they harmed Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, is tortured by the people. Yeshaya can get away with it because he is part of the royal family. And then he goes on to say, on a simple level, when a prophet's father is named, he is important, and his secret is known in his generation. Everybody knows him. Sometimes he's a prophet, sometimes not. And he goes on in that vein. But the point here is not whether Yeshaya's father was a prophet, but that Yeshaya is somebody with strong communal standing. So he rebukes King Uzziah for his arrogance. He tries to steer King Ahaz and King Chizkiyahu in their response to Assyrian threats. He tells the kings what to do. And I think that's what's happening in our Haftorah. This is really a story not about the Jews as a whole. It's the story of a conversation between Yeshaya and King Ahaz. Ahaz is an idolater, as told in the 16th chapter of Malachim Bet. He loses land to an invasion by Yisrael and Aram, who are local bullies. He's king for 16 years. He feels very threatened by the northern kingdom. He feels very threatened by Assyria. And he wants to make an alliance with others who are going to support him. Yeshaya tries to reassure him and says to him, don't turn the Jews into a vassal state of Assyria. Ahaz doesn't listen. He pays tribute to the Assyrians. And Yeshaya here is trying to inspire Ahaz to change. That's why Yeshaya presents a messianic utopia here. Even though the issue at hand is simply the Assyrian invasion. His message here is, in part, as you see in Abarbanel in source number 6, after he prophesied about the destruction, he prophesied about the redemption and consolation. I've told you the Assyrians are coming and they're going to destroy all these places. I'll also tell you about redemption. That could be. He's also, as Rashi says in source number 7, he's saying the Jews who are exiled are coming back. All those Jews who are going into exile, don't worry, they're going to return. But I think his main purpose here is to change the focus of Ahaz to a grand goal. He's using the vision to inspire Ahaz. He's saying, your monarchy is about more than just avoiding the Assyrians. Despite the mistakes you've made, you can still achieve this grand goal, this messianic time. And so he says to him, if you go back to the text, in the beginning of chapter 11, he says, a shoot is going to come forth from the stump of Yishai, of Jesse. A sprout is going to come from his roots, and he's going to have the Spirit of God, and he's going to be just, and he's going to be fair, and he's going to fear God, and all of that, right? This person is going to be part of the family, right? It's part of the line. That's his only criteria, is that he's going to be from the line of Yishai. So he's saying to King Ahaz, this could be you. You could have this relationship with God. You could achieve this grand goal. That's the message that he's trying to give to him. And he describes the animals getting along. Right? What's the image of animals getting along in this section? What does that mean to you? How would you read that? The lion and the lamb and the wolf and the kid. Like, what is that about?
Is he saying all of it?
Sorry, Ruth, and then Claudette.
The people will also be united.
So it's allegorical, in other words. It's about human beings. Right, so I'll come back to you in a second, Claudette, but take a look at source number 8. This is the Friedlander translation of the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim, God of the Perplexed. He says, each man, in proportion to his ignorance, bring great evils upon themselves and upon other individual members of the species. If men possessed wisdom, which stands in the same relation to the form of man as the sight to the eye, if people had the basic wisdom that would enable them to function the way that vision allows the eye to function, if they just had the basics of knowledge, the basics of intellect, they would not cause any injury to themselves or to others. For the knowledge of truth removes hatred and quarrels and prevents mutual injuries. People won't harm each other if they have seichel, says the Rambam. I wish that were true. That's what he says. This state of society is promised to us by the prophet in the words, and the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the cow and the bear shall feed together, the sucking child shall play on the hole of the asp, etc. The prophet also, meaning what he says is, in the event that everybody is enlightened, then nobody harms anybody else. The prophet points out what will be the cause of this change. He says that hatred, quarrel, and fighting will come to an end. Why? Because men will then have a true knowledge of God. They shall not hurt nor destroy at all my holy mountain. The earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Note it. So the statement of the Rambam is, as Ruth says, this is really a metaphor about people getting along. In the future, there will be peace among humanity. Radak brings this approach as well. Claudette.
You've just said everything that I was about to say.
Excellent. Thank you. So, yes, Eti.
Isn't it Yeshayahu that also said,
you do find that in Yeshayah, yes.
So at what point did he say that? Later on or before?
So, if I remember correctly, that's in chapter... I want to say it's chapter 2, but I'm not sure. Let's see. I want to say that was chapter 2. Yeah, it is. Chapter 2, sentence 4.
So it's before this.
Yeah. Well, before it in the book, not necessarily chronologically. There's a lot of discussion about the order of the chapters in Yeshayah and where the true beginning of the book is. That's its own discussion. Yes, Susan.
I have another question.
Oh, sorry, yeah?
Can I? Okay. I have a problem. Was Israel still, the kingdom of Israel was still there at this time?
So, if I remember correctly, at this point, they are still there.
So how is Ashur going to go all the way to Ashkelon, which is all the way to the south, without passing through Israel first?
And the answer is no, they are going to pass through. They're going to wreak havoc wherever they go. That's...
So at what point does...
I believe they get rid of, if I remember correctly, and I may not be, but I thought they actually exile the Northern Kingdom shortly after this, but not during this point in time. That's if I remember correctly. Susan.
I was wondering if this is not somehow this in my head that this was used as an example of when
Well, that's, yes, this is the utopian time that is associated with Mashiach, that is correct.
And isn't this a proof, so to speak, that there will be?
I mean, we've got many sources that show that there will be, but this is one of them. Yeah. Janine, and then Sandy.
When you said there would be peace, everyone would be united if they have seichel, but when he says knowledge of truth, does he mean knowledge of God? So it's not exactly... more.
I think to the Rambam they go together. Remember, the Rambam believes.
But then it's really, it's not just seichel, practical seichel. It's a higher level of seichel.
I suppose. Yeah.
I mean, we haven't reached that. That's why. That's
yeah.
Why we
I hear you. I hear you, Sandy.
So on a simplistic level, are we understanding that? Instead of thinking, oh, this is a prophecy, it had to have come true, but we can see today it hasn't. So this is an argument for saying that, as opposed to the prophecy, it was a promise for the future, that will come true in future generations if he sowed the seeds for it.
So that's potentially so, or it could have come. This is a prophecy of something which can happen if you live up to it, and if not, it will be in the future. Yeah. So, we said, the Rambam said, Ruth said, that this is an allegory. But not everybody agrees. there is ample text that argues that no, this is literally about the animals. We have a verse in Vayikra, Leviticus chapter 26, sentence 6, in which we are told that when we do what we're supposed to do, V'hishbati chayara amin ha'aretz, God says, I will eliminate wicked beasts from the land. What does that mean? Take a look at source number 9, two views in the Medrash. V'hishbati chayara amin ha'aretz, I will eliminate wicked beasts from the land. Rabbi Yehuda said, what does that mean? Mavi ramin olam, God gets rid of them. No more harmful creatures. Rabbi Shimon Omer Mashbisan Shelo Yizoku. Rabbi Shimon says, God stops them from causing harm. Right? It's a debate. Does God eliminate them, or does God make them good? Reminiscent of the discussion in the Gemara in Brachos between Bruria and Rabbi Meir. Right? Is it that the wicked will cease to exist, or is that the wicked will become righteous? So what Yeshaya is doing is weighing in the side of saying God does not eliminate them. They become peaceful. In other words, message to Achaz, evil can change. And the message is, if the animals can change, you can change also. So to me, that's a second reason why this would be read as a Haftorah. The Jews are coming out of Egypt. They're on their way into Israel, has been noted, but they're all coming out of Egypt, and it's an opportunity to say, there's a potential to become somebody different as they go from slavery to the presentation of the Torah. So that's a second possibility. But now I want to offer you a third possibility. The second possibility was what I said when I did this on Yom Tov last year. But then as I was going through it, I found a whole third approach here that I think is worth noting. It goes back a little bit towards what Chana said, when Chana pointed out that the text here speaks of returning to, the text speaks of returning to Israel and crossing the waters which are made dry on our behalf. If you go back to look at, which was it, chapter 11, sentence 15, Lashon Yam Mitzrayim, the tongue of the Sea of Egypt. So, not only do you have that sentence, which speaks of the water being dried up for us to return, but the whole rest of the Haftorah in chapter 12 has a water focus. Right? We say in sentence 3, chapter 12, sentence 3, first of all, sentences 1 and 2. Now that we have seen these miracles, we are confident that God is with us and that God will help us. Yes, God harmed us, but it turned out to be good for us. And then we say, you will draw water with joy from the wellsprings of salvation. Mimayinei HaYeshua, you will draw water with joy. And on that day, you're going to say, thank God, call out in His name, declare among the nations His deeds. His name is elevated. I shouldn't say it as a water theme. It's really only that one sentence. I thought about it more in terms of water before, but it's true. It's that one sentence specifically. But it's an important image. The image of drawing water with joy. What to you does that mean when you talk about drawing water with joy? What does that mean?
There is plentiful water.
Yeah, but what is it? Why drawing water specifically? There are lots of images of peace. Why that? Why drawing water?
But there is the source of life.
Yeah.
Doesn't the Torah have an analogy with water?
Good. So the first level, the most basic level, is we have a water drawing celebration. Simchas Pesach Shoeva on Sukkot, right? We pour water on the Mizbeach. It's part of our prayers for water. The Gemara in Sukkah actually connects it with that. So we have a water drawing celebration. That's one. Number two, as has been noted, water is often a metaphor for divine inspiration and education. Ein mayim ela Torah, water refers to Torah. The kior, the sink we had in the Mishkan, is associated with Torah. Take a look at source number 10. Comment of Radak. Derech Mashal, he says this is metaphorical. K'mo sho'ev mayim min ha'mayan, as one who draws water from a spring, its water will not halt because he will always find water to draw, as it is a perpetual source. It's forever being renewed. So too, blessing and salvation will not leave them. They will rejoice eternally. So there's an idea of divine blessing. And Yonatan explained, Targum Yonatan, the verse as a metaphor for learning knowledge. For knowledge is compared to water, and the teachers are springs, and the students are those who draw water. So that's a second level. When I did this last Yom Tov, somebody commented also that the elimination of dangerous animals, you're eliminating the ignorant animal in us by introducing water, by introducing this education. Okay. The a third layer to this, and this is based on a comment from Rebecca Nadler when we did this in learning Yeshaya years and years ago. The statement to Ahaz, who Yeshaya wants to change, is that your work is going to be hard. Think of Rivka at the well, right? We make a big point about that. Drawing water is hard. And what it's saying is, there will be joy with acts that have been hard. Just like drawing water is joyous, even though it is hard. Right? So there's that piece of it, there's that piece of it as well. On another layer, you will rejoice with drawing water, just like you rejoiced at the water of the sea. Just like at Yam Suf, you rejoiced then, so too you will rejoice in the future, like you rejoiced then, and that connects us back to the Yam Mitzrayim reference here as well. But I want to show you a mystical idea. And that was this was brand new to me while I was exploring this segment. If you take a look at source number 11, this comes from a book called Maasei Hashem by Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, writing in the 16th century. If you look at the heading there, you could see he had quite the journey. He starts out in Greece, he goes to Egypt, he ends up in Cyprus for, I think, 10 years, then he goes to Italy, and finally he ends up as a rabbi in Poland. So this was the full tour that he did. He probably saw lots of water. So, reading my English translation, he's the grandson of the Maharik Kolon. He says, "You have seen that just as you will find in creation of this world, the Yam, there's something called Yam, we translate Yam as the sea, water in its natural place, and other water which flows from beneath the ground, which emerges from its place, and the layer of earth is above them. You have Yam, that is on top of the seabed, and then you have water that is groundwater, that's below, underneath the surface. So, he says, in the multitudes of heaven, there is a level called Yam, and he quotes you a pasuk in Iyov, that God treads upon the heights of Yam, and a pasuk in Tehillim, you rule in the might of the Yam. And in the multitudes of heaven, there is a level called Mayim, as in the pasuk, the voice of God is upon the Mayim. So the level called Yam is lower water, it's beneath the sky. The level called Mayim is above the sky. And he gives you a reference in Tehillim that I didn't want to go into. And they are called Mayim Chayim, waters of life, which flow from the higher Eden, of which Yeshaya says, you shall draw Mayim in joy. So you have lower water that is Yam, and higher water that is Mayim. So he says, but they, the Mayim, are entirely of mercy. The word Mayim refers to water that represents divine mercy, whereas Yam is about judgment, like Yam HaMelach, the Dead Sea, where nothing can grow, and like Yam Suf, from which judgment descended upon the Egyptians. So you have Mayim, which represents mercy, and Yam, which represents judgment. And when God creates the world, Claudette, I'm going to ask you to wait. I want to get through this idea. When God creates the world, God divides the two waters. He divides between Mayim, which is the upper, the mercy one, and Yam, which is the lower one. And he says, that's the meaning of our sentence here. The land will be filled with knowledge of Hashem, like Mayim covering the Yam. Mayim covering the Yam, mercy covering up judgment. That's the idea here. That's what we're supposed to perceive. So we read this on the last day of Pesach to say, even though the water at Yam Suf was of din, was of judgment, and it was a punishment, there will be water associated with Hashem's mercy and our ultimate redemption. You follow? It's another connection for us for Pesach. Yes, Claudette. Thank you for waiting.
Thank you. When we read about Miriam's well, which Hebrew word do they use? Yam or
Mayim? Mayim.
Yeah, so mercy. Yeah.
Yeah. So, sure. So to summarize, we have at least three reasons to say that this should be read on Pesach and at the end of Pesach. The first reason doesn't really go with the end of Pesach, it's just Pesach in general, and that is that this is about Sancheirev's Assyrian invasion, which happens on Pesach, and so we read it. The weakness is we're not reading the actual story, which happens in Yeshaya. The weakness is the historical problem pointed out by Ruth Paz. It doesn't seem to fit. And I'll add what I just noted, which is the invasion happened in the beginning of Pesach. This is being read at the end of Pesach. So that's one answer. The second answer is because it's a message of change and growth, and yes, return to Israel, as well as Susan noted, and it's appropriate for the former slaves as their captors are destroyed and they move towards receiving the Torah and getting to Israel. And then the third possibility is that it's about the water imagery, drying out the waters of Egypt so that we can return to our land, and the idea of Mayim covering the Yam, water of mercy covering up the Yam that was associated with judgment. That's the third idea. Nanette, you had your hand up. I didn't know if it was your iPad.
Yes, I was wondering if there's an evocation of Noah, and the reason and the waters there. And what I'm wondering about that is in terms of the inverse. So if the first piece of that would be you describe the beasts and the wild beasts and the animals getting along, and then you talk about the allegory of a renewal or a new world, mm-hmm. and again you have that after the flood, and then finally the idea of judgment versus mercy. And I wonder, again, like Claudette, how is water referred to, during Noah's, in the story of Noah? Is it judgment? You know, is it judgment of the world and mercy of Noah and his family? Or is it judgment that, so I'm wondering if there's any link there.
Right. It's a very interesting question. And I don't remember the use of the word Yam in the waters of Noach. Certainly when it begins, it's Mabul was Mayim al Haaretz, as it starts. I just flipped back in my Tanakh to see whether I would find any reference to Yam. And right now I don't. It's a very interesting question for sure. I think in general, when we're dealing with Kabbalistic and quasi-Kabbalistic sources like this, we don't necessarily look for it to be a sign that can be extrapolated across different texts and different stories. It tends to be more local. But I'm looking through it. We do talk about the Mayanot Tehom Rabbah, the springs that are in the great depths, as well as the Arubot HaShamayim, the windows in the heavens, into repositories. And I wonder what one could do with that and what someone like Maaseh Hashem does with it, but I don't know offhand. It's a good question. Thank you. I saw a few hands. I want to make sure that I take all the hands that I saw. So, all right, I'm going to go with, for now, I'll go with Jeanette, Janine, Claudette. And if there are more, then we'll take more. Yeah, Jeanette.
So I love what Annette just said. It was actually going through my mind a little bit. Kind of the second point you brought up with a little bit of a tweak, that many people question why the animals were punished. Like, they don't have Bechira. Why did they have to be wiped out?
Yeah.
And I don't remember who said it, but there's that, a famous explanation. explanation that the hashpa'a of mankind affects animals, and if man is evil, that the hashpa'a goes, and everything had to be destroyed, not because they had bechira, but to start a new world. And I wondered if this is kind of reversed, that when we have the clarity of Yemos HaMashiach, when we have the clarity of knowing Hashem, and that will change us, and the violence, the negativity of mankind will change to positivity, and very literally might that influence the animals in a positive way. I think that's where Nanette was going. I thought that was great.
So it's an interesting idea. We do find there's a nevuah in which we talk about, a prophecy in which we talk about Hashem's spirit in the future, in this type of a time, flowing on kol basar, which is all flesh, and the Medrash in Avos Rabbi Nassim says that includes the animals. So there is such an idea that, you know, we will earn something which will affect everybody in a positive way, as opposed to the flood way. I hear that. Janine.
Okay, just kind of an aside, there is a Hasidic minhag on the last, to make the last meal of Pesach. It's called Seudat Mashiach.
Yeah.
So there is a connection. There is something about Mashiach in that last day of Pesach.
It's a good point.
That he's building. Excuse me.
No, I said it's a good point. Yeah, I hear you. Okay, Claudette.
Simple level for me is that the Hebrew word yam denotes like water that is destructive, right? And amayim is like water that is useful to us. And I thought I liked the idea of the two different words, water.
Interesting. Thank you. Other questions and comments before we go on to the Haggadah? Okay, then let's have a Haggadah thought as well.